HYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. In a few weeks, it will be the start of the new academic year for college and university students. Most schools have orientation programs warning incoming freshmen about the dangers and risks of sexual assault and harassment. Even so, about 20% of students say that they've been the victim of some kind of sexual violence on campus. The Obama administration and Senator Claire McCaskill highlighted problems on a number of campuses handling charges of sexual assault. A recent article in the New York Times about a student named Anna at Hobart and William Smith College in New York generated a huge response. She said she regretted reporting being raped after a university investigation found her alleged attackers not guilty. On the other hand, there are cases of male students who claim that they were wrongly accused of sexual assault and faced expulsion. So how should colleges and universities deal with the problem of sexual assault and harassment? We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Allison Kiss is the executive director of the Cleary Center for Security on Campus. Allison, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Brett Sokolow. He's the founder, president, and CEO of the National Center for Higher Education Risk Management. Brett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure.
Allison, let me begin with you. We're talking about Title IX, the Cleary Act. We're also talking about Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act. It seems there are a number of acts and laws that are supposed to guide colleges and universities about how to handle these cases, yet we hear that it's not happening.
Sure. So the Cleary Center was founded by parents who lost their daughter, Jean. She was brutally raped and murdered by another student whom she did not know. At the Cleary Center, our work is informed by not only technical commitment to compliance, but also an ethical commitment. Every day we walk up our stairs to our office, we see Jean's picture. We know in working with campuses that a lot of the challenge has to do with organizational dynamics on campus. There are a lot of different parties coming at this issue, the issue of sexual assault, prevention and response, from many different directions, student activists, administrators, parents. And so really looking at how can you create a culture where you don't have a student say they wish or they regret reporting. You want to create a culture where you break the silence, where students are coming forward and reporting, and they're treated fairly. Both parties are treated fairly throughout that process.
But are you saying that there's too much confusion coming from the laws, or the campuses just have so many kind of constituents they don't know how to apply the laws?
You know, often there are many constituents, but often what we see on campuses are the folks who are charged with compliance with the laws and responding are not empowered to do so. So you have people who may be experts in their field, whether it be student conduct, whether it be prevention, whether it be campus police, but they may not be empowered by their institution to have the control that they need to have. And I think we've seen a change, particularly around Title IX, where many campuses are creating Title IX positions, reporting directly to the president. So they have a direct line to the president, and that immediately gives them some institutional buy-in.
How do you see the problem?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Allison asserted, but I do think confusion about the law is a prevalent experience for college administrators as well. So part of our key role as the largest higher education-specific law practice in the country is to advise the campuses on practical application of the standards, on clarifying when necessary amongst the various laws that are in play, and then sort of fine-tuning the problem-solving aspects of making sure that everybody is treated with the essential fairness that the law requires. And one of the challenges of compliance is that it results in complaints that there's a violation of the college's policy in which one student winds up a winner and one student winds up a loser. The process is inevitably set up that way. And so someone is always dissatisfied with it. And the question is, how do we recognize the humanity of the participants, their equal dignity, in a process where someone is bound to be unhappy at some level with the outcome? And I think that's the real art of making this work when it does.
But why is this being handled by universities on a campus? If we're talking about an alleged crime, and a sexual assault clearly is an alleged crime, why don't people just go to the police and report the crime and let that part of our judicial system deal with this? Looking at you, Brett.
Yeah, I know. That's a constant refrain that I think a lot of administrators try to address, and it can be answered on so many different levels, the first of which is that campuses handle a lot of crimes. Campuses have sworn police departments. We deal with theft. We deal with arson. We deal with hazing. A lot of these behaviors are criminal. So why would a sexual violence be one we wouldn't handle is I think, one of the arguments to consider. The other is that it, I consider that argument, just take it downtown, take it to the police, take it to the municipal, I consider that an argument for rapist privilege, in a sense.
Why so?
Because you're saying, let's let them get away with it. Because the criminal justice system isn't able to handle campus cases in any meaningful way. The conviction rate is less than 0.1%, really. So if you don't handle it on a campus, then it's not really being handled anywhere. And then the third reason I'd give you is that legally, under Title IX, sexual violence is a form of unwelcome sexual advance. It's a form of sexual harassment. If a campus is obligated by Title IX to address and remedy all sexual harassment, then it must address the physical as well as the verbal. We wouldn't simply say, we're only going to handle part of this, and the rest of this we're going to push downtown.
And I do want to get to Allison, but are you saying that the college campuses then do a better job than courts and police in dealing with these issues?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the ironies of all of this. Everybody critiques the college campus, but I think they're far more proficient at this than any other entity in our society. So, you know, there's a broken system with the courts. We need to fix that. The campus system certainly can be better. We need to fix that, but it's not an either-or proposition.
Let me go back to you, Allison. Do you agree with that?
I do. I agree that we need to see more resources and support also on our college and university campuses. So by resources, one of the things we need to see is a comprehensive prevention effort. So people dedicated to focusing on prevention on the campus, not only the response issue. We also need to see advocacy on campus. So whether that be victim advocates on campus or a relationship with a local victim service agency to provide advocacy for your students. And so we have these laws. And campuses do struggle at times with how to interpret those laws and how to put them into practice. And so really what we need to see campuses do, or what campuses should look at, is their own culture, because every campus is different. A lot of the dialogue that we've heard around campus sexual assault talks about campus sexual assault as though every campus is the same.
Right.
And I think we often
right.
need to step back and think that every campus is different, from a community college, a two-year college, some beauty storefront beauty schools who are also charged with being compliant with Clery and Title IX. And so really giving tools, providing tools for these campuses so that they can look at themselves, look at their resources, look at how they'll respond to cases where it's not going to be cookie cutter. Every case is different. Every perpetrator is different. Every student who is a victim is different. And so think about responding to that.
And Clery says that colleges, universities, or maybe some of these other schools have to publish statistics about crime on campus, yes?
Sure. And, I often say when we talk about the Clery Act to look beyond the numbers, because the numbers only tell some of the story. I will, in probably another decade or so, consider sending a child to college. When I look at the Clery statistics, if I see higher numbers of sexual assaults, I'm not necessarily turning away, because to me, that tells me that this campus is talking about it. Students know how to identify it, they know where to report it, and they're getting the help they need. They're going through that not saying, I regret reporting. They're going through that experience thinking, this was fair, this was prompt, this was equitable. And so more students, if you build it, they will come, essentially.
Let me go back to something Senator Claire McCaskill said, and this is part of her investigation into 440 schools, finding that 30% of schools do not receive training on how to respond to sexual assault reports. Does that square with your understanding about how you work in many ways for colleges and universities, representing them? Does that seem on mark?
Plausible, yeah. I think that's well within the realm of possibility. You know, there are a number of models out there that campuses use. Some use sort of the single-figure model of a point person for all intake. If you're victimized, if you experience something, you go to this person. They're knowledgeable. They're trained. Other campuses use sort of the SART model of a response team and a large number of people who are trained with a no-wrong-doors approach, which I think is very smart. Doesn't matter who you go to on a campus. There's some level of training. People know how to get you to the right people, even if they're not the right door. But I still think there are a lot of campuses out there that do very minimal to no training on this. But again, I'd ask the question, what were those campuses? Were they community colleges, which experienced relatively little sexual violence and more sexual harassment? Or were they residential campuses, where I think the norm is that we train housing and residence life staff, RAs, head residents. They're rarely well trained on this sort of intake. But I think there's always a gap, potentially, that a victim accesses someone who doesn't know the right answer. And it's one of the reasons why I'm glad that the SAVE Act is going to require sort of a pamphlet or a brochure so that everybody does have in their hands quality information. What are my rights? What are my options? What are the resources in the campus and in the community that are available? And I think campuses would be wise to create that sort of reference material for not only the victim, but also the person who's accused. What is this process going to be like for me? And I think that's part of how we show support to all members of our community.
Do you agree with that, Allison?
I do. I think that our training, too, also has to, again, take into account the unique nature of every college and university and to give them tools to put this into practice. So I think that there are model policies out there. The challenge that I see sometimes is that campuses say, I've modeled my policy after this model policy. But you really want to think about it from, again, people coming at this in multiple directions. One of the things that I'm excited about this year, we sit on the advisory board for the National Center for Campus Public Safety, funded by Congress. It has the backing of the White House. And one of the things they're doing is pulling together a true multidisciplinary team to inform an investigator training, to really look at different models, how they work on the ground from different perspectives, a forensic perspective, law enforcement perspective, student conduct perspective, and really collecting data on what the needs are, taking a true needs assessment of what campuses are struggling with, because there have been systems in place, there have been trainings, ours included, in place. But it's a matter of we're still seeing kind of campus struggling with this, struggling with the true adjudication process when it happens in practice. And time again, we hear stories about something that was said to a student reporting. And it's a comment that you think there's no way somebody would possibly make this comment, but the comment's made. And you can't take that human behavior out of the equation. So how do you create a process? And I think that will continue to be an ongoing struggle.
And if I could jump on that, I think it's a training issue, but I also think there are certain people who just should not be doing intake. And part of what we have to identify are
this would be intake people who are charging or claiming that they've been
for first responders to a victimization. You know, if you're saying the wrong thing, maybe I can train you. That's insensitive. But if it's enormously insensitive, like what was alleged in the UConn case, you know, recently with a campus police officer, you have the wrong personnel in place if that's happening. And I think there's got to be a process whereby the Title IX coordinator or the other administrator who's in charge of this on campus identifies those people, pulls them out of the loop. I think campuses have put law enforcement forward on being the first responder, and I think we're starting to see a shift away from that, which I think is very positive, to an administrative response, to a more sensitized response. I'm not saying all police officers are insensitive, but that there is a disconnect if somebody is reporting a policy violation and has no interest in reporting a crime into why we're sending them to a police agency to report it.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Brett Sokolow. He's the founder, president, CEO of the National Center for Higher Education Risk Management. He works with colleges and universities in cases involving sexual assault cases on college campuses, the topic in this hour of Radio Times. Also with us is Allison Kiss. She's the executive director of the Cleary Center for Security on Campus. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at whyy. Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Did you grow up in a chaotic household or live with someone who abused drugs or alcohol? Over 60% of Americans grow up experiencing some type of household dysfunction, abuse, or neglect. The Penn Center for Women's Behavioral Wellness supports WHYY and is seeking menopausal women between the ages of 48 and 60 who experienced a stressful or chaotic childhood to participate in a study examining how early life stress affects memory later in life. Study participation includes brain imaging, blood draws, and memory tests. More information by contacting Claudia at 215-41-STUDY.
Here's how to be a good contestant on Ask Me Another, NPR's hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia. Tip one, if you don't know the answer, guess.
Driving Michael Phelps.
Could I say right now that I would totally watch the TV show Driving Michael Phelps?
Remember what show you're on.
That is correct. We're not on Jeopardy, but you're right.
Tune in and shout out answers every week on Ask Me Another.
Saturday nights at 8, beginning August 2nd on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Retirement is part of the American dream. Live life your way at Laurel Lake Retirement Community in Hudson. Enjoy a custom-designed home with country club amenities.
But some seniors are moving into RVs, traveling the country looking for work. The new Okies of the Great Recession, next time on Here and Now from NPR and WVUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Brett Sokolow and Allison Kiss about colleges and how they should handle sexual assault cases on campus. And it looks like we have an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. Allison, going through a number of the cases that have come to light in recent months having to do with sexual assault, it seems that alcohol is a problem. Often it's freshmen who are the alleged victims, and it often seems like it's the athletes who are the alleged perpetrators. Is that what we're talking about, largely?
So I think alcohol is certainly connected to sexual assault on college and university campuses. There's quite a bit of research out there. Notably, Dr. David Lisak talks about serial perpetration. So alcohol really is a tool for somebody who wants to commit sexual assault and do so often. It's a tool particularly when you're looking for a student who may be vulnerable, so a freshman, for example, who may be at a social outing and who may not know people. It certainly can be a tool to incapacitate someone and certainly make it easier to complete a sexual assault. So it is very relevant in what we see and in the education that we do.
How about for you, Brett?
Yeah, I think that victimization spans the entire campus spectrum, employees, seniors, you know, so it's important to focus on the highest risk areas, but not to the exclusion of all students who are at risk and the protection of all members of the community. I certainly think athletes are disproportionately involved in perpetration. There are a number of reasons for that. Alcohol is a facilitator. Alcohol is not the cause of sexual violence, but it certainly is a facilitator.
On
both sides, no question. And then that makes it a complicating factor when the campus is trying to untangle what took place in terms of the responsibilities of the individuals who are involved. But I think it's very important to have a clear message from campus policy and in terms of policymakers that a victim is not responsible or at fault for their own alcohol consumption if someone else takes advantage of their incapacitated state once they get to that point. So there's a lot of talk about sort of excusing bad behavior because somebody is drinking. And I think we have to hold the perpetrator of those behaviors accountable for those behaviors. I think campuses are getting better at that.
Let me ask you about these boards, and these are boards where people sit on them. Sometimes there's a student representative, they're members of administration, and they're there to hear these cases. And a number of questions have been raised about who sits on the board, the training of the board, questions of confidentiality, evidence, rights, you know, all the things that one would think of in a court of law. I'm looking at you, Allison, first, and then, Brett, I'll get you in on this as well.
Boards need to be trained, and anyone hearing these cases needs to be trained. They're serious cases with serious consequences. That being said, when these boards are trained, there needs to be training that explains the dynamics of victimization, a trauma-informed approach, knowing how trauma affects victims, but also trained to not be victim advocates. It is not their role to be victim advocates in these hearings. They hear some incredibly sad and horrendous stories, but they have to decide these cases in a fair manner. So it's a really incredible responsibility. And the training, if I were asked to sit on a board, I would demand that I was trained. I wouldn't need the new Violence Against Women Act amendments to the Clery Act, which people informally call Campus Save, is going to require that training. And if I were sitting on a board, I would require that before legislation told me to. It would be essential to my serving on that board.
Go ahead, Brett.
As someone who trains these kinds of boards for a living, this might be a somewhat peculiar statement, but I think they're dreadful.
Do you?
I do, and I've been pushing higher education for 17 years to move away from this model. It's really a square peg and round hole. I find that in order to train a board to comprehensively address these issues at the level that I need them to be proficient, would require 4 straight days of training. It's exhausting. Nobody devotes that amount of time. The existence of faculty members and students on these boards serves as a disincentive for victims to come forward because they have fears for confidentiality. And so we've been advocating and so pleased to see campuses responding to moving toward a civil rights investigation model where investigators go out, they're trained professionals, they collect information, they render a finding. If ultimately that's contested to an appeal, it's contested to an appeal. But it's sort of this panel model that I think is really what's broken for so many campuses, and one of the telltales of that are these attack stories that you're seeing in the media saying this panel didn't get it right, this panel didn't have the right sensitivities. Why don't we take that away from them and put it in the hands of trained professionals? Is I think the right approach to be taking at this point.
And I don't want to get too deep into particular cases, but this William and Hobart Smith case, and I know you've been hired by the college to investigate, I guess, the appeal in this case. But nonetheless, this was the student Anna. I'm looking at something that Emily Bazelon wrote in Slate, saying, looking at the hearing, no students were allowed to bring lawyers or family members, just advisors who weren't allowed to talk. Panelists misrepresented evidence. Two or three panelists didn't look at this woman's medical records. Both accused players changed their story in significant ways before the hearing. Neither were asked to explain the discrepancies. I mean, these are complicated cases. Oftentimes, there are no witnesses or maybe one or two witnesses, and someone's future is on the line. You want to add to that?
Yeah, no matter how well you do it, you're always susceptible to attack, I think, when that's the approach that you take. And so the trained investigator model is, I think it's non-adversarial, which is one of the most humane things. You talk about panels not being survivor-centered. They ask the wrong questions sometimes. They're not particularly sensitive. The trained investigator has the forensic background. They understand the effects of alcohol or rape drugs or whatever may be in play. And so they're actively collecting the information that helps to determine whether the university's policy was violated. And they do that on the basis of a preponderance of evidence standard, what's more likely than not, which again is what has some activists on the other side of the equation up in arms, is it's very easy to find an accused student, often a male, in violation of policy. Again, another reason why I want it to be more than a 4 or 5 hour hearing. Mm-hmm. I want somebody to invest weeks in this. That's what a good investigation takes on a sexual misconduct complaint, to turn over every rock, to determine what's there and who did what to whom. And again, because we spend so much time training these investigators, I have an enormous faith in the effectiveness of that approach versus the hearing model, the panel model, really is a legacy of campuses hearing alcohol violations or somebody pulling a fire alarm, other kinds of behaviors that are often one party. But for a two-party model, it's not an effective conflict resolution mechanism at all.
Go ahead, Allison.
I do disagree. I think we need to empower campuses to respond to these cases, to have the experts on staff, to be trained on staff. And if that takes 4 days, then it takes 4 days.
4 days doesn't seem like a very long time.
And to be quite honest, one of the programs that we've had that we've evaluated that has been the most successful is a collaborative learning program where campuses sign up teams, and these teams go through a year-long commitment of self-assessment. So they're not outsourcing. You can outsource assessment. They assess themselves. They look internally at what they're doing poorly. There's also the option to do so with a peer organization. They're going through training, both virtually, in-person training, and it's a commitment. It's a job, and it's a serious job, and it's a commitment they need to take. I think it's almost giving up by saying we're going to outsource these investigations, we're going to outsource these panels, these hearings. And I agree with Brett. I think there are cases that we have heard about where the panels have acted in an insensitive manner. I also know of a lot of institutions who have invested a lot of time, and they don't have the resources to outsource them to an investigator. They have folks on staff who are committed, who have given the 4 days, the week, the year mm-hmm. in terms of the program, where they are committed to changing the culture. And I think in order to change the culture, that's what we need to do.
Well, and just a quick follow-up here. I mean, we often hear about the terrible cases, the miscarriage of justice, if I can say that. But what you're saying, Allison, is that there are colleges and universities who are doing this right.
Right, and they're not going to make the headlines. I think in particular there was an institution in the Mid-Atlantic region where we met with the director of public safety. They were making some dramatic changes around investigating, around reporting, and we went in and spoke with their board of trustees, with their president, with their cabinet, and talked about higher numbers not being a bad thing, that people were coming forward. And they did almost a PR campaign about, look at all of this stuff that we're doing, and because we're doing this, we are breaking the silence. People will report. And so far, it's been successful. Mm.
Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, I think we're talking past each other on a key point, which is the question of what the model is, not who performs the investigation. And so, yeah, certainly you could outsource this. You could insource it. I don't have a preference in particular for how a campus approaches it. From a model perspective, what I'm talking about is the ability to provide the service proficiently and not do it through a hearing panel, but through a civil rights investigation. Again, you can turn to external sources for that. You can do it internally. I train the internal folks all the time, so I think there's very much strength in that model. And those folks know their own campuses really well. So again, I think there's much to commend that. Mm-hmm. That takes more than 4 days, right? That's just training a panel versus training investigators is a whole different skill set. And it's the panel model that I object to, not the question of who actually provides the investigation.
And there was a change, I think, in 2011 from preponderance of evidence, I guess, to preponderance of evidence versus beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, this sounds like really in the weeds here, but that's a significant thing, is it not?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's a mischaracterization, not on your part, but on the part of people who say this, to say there was a change. 80% of colleges or more, as of 2011, were already using the preponderance of evidence standard. Only a few very elite schools, just a handful, were using higher standards. Maybe clear and convincing evidence, very few using proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So very few campuses were actually required to make a change as a result of this. It was just a clarification by the Department of Education. And in terms of the preponderance of evidence standard, people think that it's a weak standard. They're concerned that you can kick somebody out of school with you know, what is a fairly minimal amount of evidence, but it is the only standard that creates a level playing field between men and women. The whole point of Title IX is to create gender equity. And if you use a higher standard, you are typically advantaging men over women. Why shouldn't we go into an environment where there's a level playing field, where it takes no more evidence to convince someone that a policy was violated than that it doesn't? That, to me, is the heart of the preponderance concept.
Do you want to add to that, Allison? Then we'll get to our callers.
No, I agree. I think it's not the criminal justice system. I think Brett referenced earlier that folks will often say, well, why don't we let our criminal justice system handle this? Why don't we? And it's not the criminal justice system. And often when campus, when they're referred to as cases found guilty, often students are found responsible or not responsible, and thinking about them as they are adjudications, and they are using the lower standard as they should. I agree wholeheartedly with Brett.
And that's Allison Kiss, Executive Director of the Cleary Center for Security on Campus. Brett Sokolow, Founder, President, and CEO of the National Center for Higher Education Risk Management. We are talking about sexual assault on college campuses and how it can be dealt with. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Sam to join us. Sam from West Mount Airy. Go ahead, Sam.
Good morning. Hi, Brett and Allison. I teach continuing legal education in this area, and my experience teaching this, these allegations and alleged incidents arising out of sexual assault are serious crimes, and the ramifications are felonies if convicted in a court of law. And I'm increasingly hearing from experts in this area, and I myself have actually coming around to the view that we're doing the wrong thing here. I really believe that these are best handled by trained police departments with special victims units, special sex crimes units. I teach sometimes with Gina Smith and Leslie Gomez, who are experienced formerly sex prosecutors in sex crimes units. And the colleges just aren't trained to handle these. And the ramifications for the students on both ends are extremely serious. Certainly, there's testimony in these hearings and so forth.
Right.
And I've had defense lawyers and also prosecutors say that they would much prefer that these hearings not occur if this proceeds to a criminal proceeding because of all the legal ramifications. And so I'd like our panelists to comment on this growing body of thought.
Yeah, and we touched on this earlier, but obviously Sam takes it to a different level. And go ahead, Brad, and then Allison, I'd like to hear from you.
Yeah, I think we can amplify on what we said earlier in terms of turning this over to criminal justice authorities on two points, one of which is that campuses police behaviors much more broadly than the law does. So if you argue that a campus sexual assault policy, what we would call sexual misconduct, could simply be referred to criminal justice authorities, it may not even be a crime. The campus is saying these are community standards. These are the behaviors we want to our students to treat each other with respect about. And so some of the behaviors aren't actually criminal. So there's a disconnect there. But the other area where I would be concerned about Sam's approach is in victim empowerment. A lot of survivors don't want to go to the police. Campuses are not in the position of forcing them to do that or giving them no other option. So for victims who want to go to the police, we'll absolutely do that. We'll help them.
They can do that, right?
Well, nothing not only that, but federal law requires us to assist them in doing so for a college administrator. So sure, we're there for that, and it doesn't foreclose other options. But to simply say that victims only have one option when it's not the option most victims choose, I don't think that's the way we want to be supporting our students who experience victimization.
Go ahead, Allison.
In a former life, I served as a police liaison, so I trained officers to respond to domestic violence, dating violence, stalking, and sexual assault. And the training there is also a challenge, similar to some of the training that we talked about on college and university campuses. That trauma, there's a lot of training right now with law enforcement outside of campus as well as on campus to take this trauma-informed approach. So the criminal justice system hasn't gotten it right either. I think if they did, I don't think we probably wouldn't have as many campus cases. I think the sexual assault in general is underreported across the board, not only on campus. And so to get people to come forward and to report, we haven't done so yet. And I think it's because when people are coming forward and reporting, more often than not, they're not being treated in a victim-centered approach. They're not being empowered to make choices. And I think what's kind of dangerous, some of the conversations that have been talked about on campus is, well, we should make them report to law enforcement. We should push the reports to law enforcement. And as Brett mentioned, federal law right now says you have to give that option. You don't want to dissuade someone. You don't want to persuade someone. You give the option and you empower. Empowerment counseling is about empowering victims to get power back. Rape, sexual assault is about power and control. We want to empower them to make decisions that are best for them.
Going back to you, Allison, if someone is found, quote unquote, guilty then of a sexual assault, let's say even a rape on a college campus, they are generally, what, expelled? Do they appeal their case to a criminal court? I mean, what is the process once a verdict has been rendered?
Are you talking about the campus process?
Campus process.
It depends on the campus. They have to make their sanctions available in terms of what the sanction options are. Sometimes you may have a student, a student survivor who says, I don't want the accused student expelled. I just want them suspended so I can finish my education. So I think that in terms of what happens, it's going to depend case to case, campus to campus, and what their sanction model is.
But I mean, if this was a crime that was committed and a serious and a violent crime, someone could serve prison, you know, they could be 10 feet off of campus and they could go to jail.
Yeah, the average sentence for sex crime is 7 years in this country. So what is a suspension when compared to that? I think, you know, we take the victim's wishes into account, but ultimately the campus has to protect its community from repeat perpetration, from the pattern offense. And so, you know, I have always been a fan of stringent sanctions for serious misconduct. If you commit the equivalent of rape on a college campus, you should be expelled. If you commit a serious, you know, sexual assault that is maybe a non-penetration offense, I want to see a very long suspension with conditions for return. And we're not making it easy for you to come back. You've got to demonstrate that you're safe to return and that you're not going to harm the community again. But there are campuses out there that impose probations and warnings and slaps on the wrist and suspended suspensions. And one of the critiques is that educators try to educate rapists too much. And I think that that's a critique that really is warranted in these situations. We've got to put our protection hat on more so than our developmental, encourage the maturation and educator's hat when it comes to sanctioning this misconduct. And when we do, I think victims will perceive that we take these cases seriously.
Sam, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We are talking about how colleges should handle sexual assault cases on college campuses. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and continue our conversation with you as well. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents Old Crow Medicine Show, Jason Isbell, Janice Ian, Loudon Wainwright III, Natalie McMaster, Tempest, The Lone Bellow, Tommy Emmanuel, Sarah Jaroche, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, it's the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 14th through the 17th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
Have I stayed away too long?
On the next Fresh Air, Dom Flemons, a former member of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, performs in our studio. His new solo album includes old-timey music, blues, early jazz, and some originals. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Is this what they mean by a good guy with a gun?
A woman named Anna Marie Yoakum was found dead, shot in her home in South Bend, Indiana. She had been shot 3 times, apparently at close range.
A profile of the NRA's general counsel and the surprising skeletons in his closet. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. Just a quick recap here. Earlier this spring, the Department of Education identified more than 50 colleges for possible Title IX violations for their handling of complaints of sexual assault and harassment. Earlier this summer, Senator Claire McCaskill painted a troubling picture of college campuses not complying with federal law requirements for handling sexual assault cases, and this was in a survey of 440 schools. An estimated 20% of college students report that they have been the victim of sexual violence. We're talking about all of this with Allison Kiss, Executive Director of the Cleary Center for Security on campus, and Brett Sokolow, President and CEO of the National Center for Higher Education Risk Management. I have an email from Michael. Says, my experience is that with the board model, the dean of students' office or the equivalent is as interested in protecting the institution and keeping their numbers down as they are in finding a proper resolution. Allison, if I can go back to you and get your response to that. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Sure. When the Cleary Center was founded by the Clearys, no one was really talking about campus crime. And then the Clearly Act was passed, and there was limited enforcement. I think we've moved to a place where many campuses are looking at how can we improve. Certainly we have seen headlines of grave mistakes and errors that have been tragic to students. But I do think campuses are looking at how can we improve. And, you know, there's research to show that it's very little who want to kind of hide numbers or cover numbers. So it's a matter of if you're out there, if you're reporting, again, to do what I talked about, doing that PR around it. We're talking about it. We're breaking the silence. We're getting people to come forward. A lot of that coupled with the student activism movement that has been going on for the last 2 years, you know, really moving beyond, I think maybe 2 decades ago, we would talk about Jane Doe and there'd be a blurred face on the screen talking about their experiences. We're hearing those same experiences today, but with names and with faces that look like our daughters and our friends and people we know. And I think it has really rattled both the government and many organizations and institutions of higher education, and that we're getting to a place where we're looking at changing.
Well, and you work with these colleges and universities.
I do. And, you know, anytime an organization is engaged in self-policing members of its own community, there's, I think, the argument that there's self-dealing, that they're trying, there's an attempt to protect the image of the organization. But the deans I work with, and again, we have more than 3,000 higher education clients, so I've got a pretty decent idea of the breadth of this, they're sincere. They are not acting to protect any particular individual. They're trying to do this well, and they're working in a very challenging environment with limited resources to do it. There's obviously corruption in any field, but by and large, the people I work with are dedicated, they're committed, and they're moving this wheel forward. There's progress being made. It's tough to see it sometimes, and I know individual survivors don't always particularly, you know, appreciate the macro scale of how where an institution came from before they got there, as opposed to where it's going to once they leave. But I do see progress being made.
Well, I have interviewed a number of, in particular, Laura Dunn, who was at the University of Wisconsin. Again, we can't use one case to describe all cases, but, you know, she described being raped by two members of the crew team. She filed a complaint with the school, with law enforcement. No one was charged. No disciplinary action was taken. There are these examples and these stories where you feel like someone really had their rights violated.
Yeah, when I entered this field 17 years ago, the ability of a campus panel to find a violation, victims weren't getting anything from that. Maybe slaps on the wrist if there was a finding of violation. Also, we went from ignoring victims to a position now where some campuses have overreacted to all the efforts from the Department of Education and from Washington, and they're holding men accountable when they didn't do anything because they think they're supposed to. So it's interesting what the progress looks like. We've gone from one extreme to the other. Now it's about finding the right mean and finding the right balance between the rights of everybody who's involved, so that campuses are doing the right thing by all students. But yeah, the constant refrain a generation ago was that victims never got their say. Today, I think that still happens, but I think it is far less than it used to be.
But do you think the pendulum has swung too far? The pendulum between the victim or the alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator?
No, I think there are tools now. If you feel the process was not fair, if you feel the process was not in any way in your favor or was heavily in one side's favor, you can file a complaint. And that's what we've seen students do. Coming from an organization, our organization used to be a watchdog because our founders were quite honestly screaming about it on mountaintops because nobody else was. Well, now we're seeing whistleblowers, members of Congress, students coming forward empowered to file complaints. To file complaints, they don't need a lawyer to file a complaint. They can file a complaint on their own. They can send an email to the Department of Education. And one of the things we're seeing from the White House task force is we're going to take these complaints seriously and we're going to be transparent about who's under investigation, what they're under investigation for. And I think it has it's a tool that students have. So if they feel that a case has they've been treated poorly or something has been gone wrong, the panel has acted in a way that they shouldn't have, then they have recourse.
Mm. Maybe. You know, the reality is, and I think a lot of the survivor groups have said this, that the recourse they have through the complaint process, the Department of Education, rarely changes the outcome of cases. It takes forever to do that. And so they're looking to see fines. They're looking to see, you know, ways to apply more pressure so that they have more direct recourse. And I think that's one of the things that we're hearing is that there's no sort of way to fix what happened to them, which is why I want to be so focused on prevention, right? That whole idea that if you want to make sure this doesn't happen, we can't have this entire conversation for an hour about response and how universities respond and don't respond. We have to talk about the resources we're allocating toward making sure this isn't happening to students who arrive on our campuses in the fall.
Well, go ahead.
A common thread we hear from students is, we don't want this to happen to other students. And so when that complaint is filed, something that we've seen consistent is changes that happen at that university, even before an outcome is reached. And so I think that something we often tell institutions to do is look at program reviews from the Department of Education. The content in there is instructional. It can help you to put a comprehensive prevention effort in place. If campuses nowadays are asking me, who can I look at? I'm looking for a large state institution to model what I'm going to do around Cleary after. I would say look at Penn State. And Penn State we're still waiting for the outcome of their Cleary review. They have put Cleary compliance coordinators in place. They have institutionalized training. They have done train the trainer. They have set up a reporting process. Is it a little too late? Yes, and I think that's what we're getting from a lot of the complaints that are filed. So learn
because there's some kind of a crisis too,
right? And so they're reacting and they're putting systems in place, but there's also some mistrust and harm that's been done. So look at those cases, look at the work that they're doing in reaction to complaints, and start to look at how you can mirror that on your campus before a complaint is filed.
I got to get some callers, and we have Chris from Haddonfield joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Welcome.
I think I read at the National Institutes of Health that over 600,000 18 to 24-year-olds experience sexual harassment on campus because of alcohol. And I wondered, when we talk about prevention, what campuses are doing about that relationship between alcohol and sexual harassment, sexual assault.
Let me toss that to you, Brett.
Sure. I think many campuses are acutely aware of the relationship being exactly what the caller just said it was, and so you can't address the behaviors in a vacuum. If you're going to talk about sexual violence, you have to be talking about alcohol and other drugs. And if we can reduce the incidence of both and their use in combination, then we're effective. And really, this is a primary prevention challenge, right? A primary prevention is something that stops a rapist from committing a rape. And we really have some methodologies available to us, whether it's environmental management or social norming or bystander engagement, right? Getting somebody who's about to witness something going down and getting them to engage the situation to make sure that it doesn't happen. We have those mechanisms, and the training that campuses are providing now, in part because federal law is going to mandate this coming soon, is focusing in on precisely those issues. And I'm very hopeful that when campuses learn the technology, right? I don't mean the electronics, but the technology of prevention, and there's enough funding and the White House is pushing this, which I think is a wonderful thing, that we have, you know, the models that are at the University of New Hampshire right now and at Arizona State, that we have them replicated from campus to campus to campus. What Allison was saying a moment ago about Penn State is so true. They've mastered this Clery Act compliance piece, but because they were scarred, right? It's now the question is proactively, can other campuses look at what they're doing and say, we don't have to go through this to learn the lesson the hard way. Let's put these structures in place now proactively.
Can you talk, I mean, we've done whole hours on drinking and drugs on campus as well, but the association between drinking and sexual assault. And, you know, oftentimes this is a child's first time away from home. They feel empowered. They have friends around them. They might be at a, you know, at some kind of a party somewhere and end up doing things that they wouldn't do if they were not drunk.
And we know that campuses with higher level of alcohol abuse have higher levels of violence across the board in general. So I agree with Brett. You need to take a comprehensive approach. You need to understand your climate. And there's been a lot of talk about climate surveys. Title IX talks about climate surveys. You need to do a comprehensive scan of your climate and your environment. And Brett referenced kind of the public health model, you know, really looking at this tiered approach to prevention. Mm-hmm. So often we hear from campuses that have this kind of lone soldier approach. That's our prevention person.
What does that mean?
The catch-all. They are responsible for drug and alcohol prevention, sexual violence prevention. Maybe if they're lucky, they have two separate offices. We need to take a more holistic approach. And to be quite honest, it starts before college. We need to see this at the high school level. We need to see class time. We need to see a discussion about transition to college, or if not college, the outside world, because these social issues, social problems are all over society. And so it needs to be prevention that starts early and it happens often.
Very quickly. Now get Gary and Chris, thanks for the call.
Yeah, and I think colleges need to view prevention as an investment, right? For the donors who are listening, potentially for the administrators who are listening, that if you are putting the resources and the time and the effort into preventing these behaviors, then you get that back on the back end in spades. You're spending less time trying to put out fires. You're not on the front page of the New York Times. You're not subject to an OCR complaint or a lawsuit. But campuses can fund buildings. They can fund sporting activities. Putting the money toward prevention, you know, this one person Allison referenced, she's working in one office. She's got an annual budget of $25,000 to prevent every rape on a campus, and she's just out of graduate school. And everybody looks and says, well, why isn't it working?
Right.
And it's a resource allocation issue. You've got to make that investment.
Let me get Gary from Elkins Park to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have been through this with a daughter who was subject of sexual assault.
I'm sorry.
And one of the issues that comes up is that the process, and I think it was mentioned by one of your speakers, the process may take a very long time, for example. And she went both to the college campus and their procedures, and also as a civil at the Special Victims Unit, and was assigned an attorney, and the alleged was also assigned an attorney. But and you have to put this in context of one of these young students. They may have a heavy college load, courses. They want to stay. They want to succeed. They want to accomplish their goal of getting a degree. But this is not happening in a vacuum when they get abused.
Sure.
And the delay, what this does is it keeps it in their head. It can dominate their life because they're waiting to see, you know, what can happen. And, for example, in the civil case, the defendant attorney kept getting delays that lasted and seemed endless. And it was dragging on for 6-8 months, and my daughter was carrying this around with her, and finally she just got so disgusted with it, she couldn't take it anymore. She wanted to move forward and just that was it. She just wasn't interested because nothing was happening.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear that.
You know, and I think that's a problem, to keep delaying month after month after month when you have dates and the attorney, you know, it's just not a primary goal of the legal system in my area. And the other thing is,
well, you know what, Gary, and I hate to do this to you. First of all, I really appreciate you calling in and telling this story, and I hope your daughter is doing okay. And I do want to give our guests a chance to respond. I mean, this is a story, Brett, of frustration with the civil system.
Yeah, but I think things are changing. I have no idea when Gary's daughter was assaulted, but since 2011, colleges and universities have, under Title IX, been under a federally enforced promptness requirement for exactly the reasons he talks about. Justice delayed is justice denied. And the longer it's drawn out, the more difficult it is for a victim to catch up with their studies and to experience college the way they originally wanted to. And so the promptness requirement is a 60-day, you know, goal, start to finish. Most colleges are getting better about meeting that. But the other thing that campuses are doing now, which is different than before, is they're providing remedies and accommodations. So a victim who is struggling academically is getting support. They're not washing out of the program. They're federally required to do this as well. So there's support structures that are in place now. No contact orders, interim suspensions are really light years from where we were 10 years ago.
Gary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Allison, I have an email for you from Frizzell. How do you protect male victims from false claims by women? Not using a very high standard of proof seems to shift the risk.
Sure. There are false reports that happen. I think we can't deny that, but they're a small percentage. So by having a practice on campus that is fair, and I talked about training the folks hearing these cases not to be victim advocates, but to be sensitive to the dynamics. So I think we don't deny that there is research that shows there are false reports, but again, they are so low. And the organization that I work for really focuses on empowering campuses to have a process that is fair, empowering campuses to have services. Brett talked about accommodations, making sure that there are accommodations for students as soon as they report. That's what the law says. Mm-hmm. So before we know of the outcome, campuses should be empowered to offer accommodations for students, whether it be a change in housing, whether it be a change in living situation. What the new Violence Against Women Act amendments to the Clery Act do, they really modernize the 92 Sexual Assault Campus Victim Bill of Rights by saying you actually have to, because we know students are most likely experiencing trauma, you have to provide them with these rights in writing. So after you explain them to them, they can actually go back and process what they've received and understand what decision to make from there.
Very quickly, we are almost out of time here, Brett, but it looks like you want to add something.
Yeah, just that I think it's a little bit of a garbage in, garbage out phenomenon for campuses, where if policy is weak or it doesn't clearly define standards, then you wind up holding men or women accountable if they're accused for things they didn't do. So strong policy really can make a difference in these cases.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Brett Sokolow, founder, president, and CEO of the National Center for Higher Education Risk Management. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Allison Kiss, Executive Director of the Clery Center for Security on Campus. Allison, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Carry on a conversation that we started on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.